The first lecture is going to be on belief in God. Now, a rabbi and an astrophysicist were both on an airplane. They were sitting next to each other, and the astrophysicist asked the person next to him, you know, what do you do for a living? He says, I'm a rabbi. He says, very nice. He says, what do you do for a living? He says, I'm an astrophysicist. So after a while, they're conversing, and the astrophysicist says to the rabbi, you know, I guess all of religion and all of theology could be subsumed into that one pithy statement, love thy neighbor as thyself. So the rabbi's a little taken aback, and he says, you know, I think that all of astrophysics could probably be subsumed into that one pithy statement, twinkle, twinkle, little star. The truth of the matter is that you can't subsume all of religion into love thy neighbor as thyself, nor can you subsume all of astrophysics into twinkle, twinkle, little star. It's much more than that. But belief in God is certainly one of the major challenges that we have when we're dealing with religion and with faith. Now, for many, many, many centuries, for millennia, people have been trying to prove God's existence. And you know that there are many classical attempts to prove God's existence, proofs of God's existence. So for instance, you have St. Anselm, Thomas Aquinas. In Judaism, we have the Rambam, Maimonides in the 13th century, 12th and 13th century, his Guide to the Perplexed. You have right before him Rabbi Judah Halevi in his book, The Kuzari. So for centuries and millennia, people have been trying to prove God's existence. And for centuries and millennia, people have been trying to disprove God's existence. I don't believe that anyone has ever proven God's existence. And I don't believe that anyone has ever disproven God's existence. I don't believe that you can prove God's existence. And I'll explain to you in a moment why. But I do believe that there are many, many evidences that we can bring to bear that indicate God's existence. Many, many indications of God's existence in this world. And a very persuasive case can be made for God's existence from many different disciplines. In the 17th century, early and mid-17th century, there was a Christian theologian, a Jesuit, Blaise Pascal. And he wrote a very famous book, The Pensées. And he comes up with a very, very interesting, what's known as Pascal's Conundrum. Or Pascal's Wager. Pascal's Wager or Conundrum. Listen to what he says. He says, if I live a religious life, and then after I die, I discover that there was no God. All this time I've been living a fraud. Then what have I lost? I lived a good life. I did acts of righteousness, kindness. What have I lost? But if I live my life as if there is no God, and when I die I find out that I was wrong my whole life, then I'm in trouble. In other words, what he says that we got to cover our bases, we have to cover our rear, we have to be very, very careful. Because if I lived a good life, what have I lost? But if I didn't, then I may very well be in trouble. Now in Judaism, we generally speak of belief in God. We don't speak about knowledge of God in general. We speak of belief. Ani ma'amin. We have the 13 principles of belief of Maimonides, the 13 principles of belief. By the way, he did not write Ani ma'amin. It was written later, but it's based on his 13 principles that he brings down in his work. But that formulation of Ani ma'amin, I believe, is not his. We don't speak about knowledge of God because it's virtually impossible. It is impossible for a mortal to master the immortal. We're mortal. And that's why Rabbi Yosef Albo, who is a theologian of the 14th century, wrote in his Sefer Ikarim a very, very interesting statement. He said, "Ilu yidativ hayitiv. If I knew God, I would be God." Because it's impossible for the mortal mind to understand and to master the immortal. So while we can't prove God's existence, we can bring to fore enough evidence to reduce the doubt. And that's really what we're trying to do. Now in the Talmud, in Tractate Shabbat, they bring three cases of a proselyte, of a potential convert, who comes to the rabbis and asks to be converted. Some of you may know the very, very famous case. The proselyte, the potential convert, comes before Shammai and he says, "Convert me," while standing on one foot. Remember that case? What does Shammai do? Shammai was very rigid. He throws him out. Comes to Hillel and he says to Hillel, "Teach me the whole Torah while standing on one foot." And what does Hillel say to him? "Madalach sane, what is hated unto you, don't do unto others." It's basically what the astrophysicists say. Love thy neighbor as thyself, in a negative way. That's the whole Torah. The rest is commentary. There's more to that. Go and learn. Go and study. Everybody forgets that part. Go and study. Doesn't mean that you end there. There's a second case where a potential proselyte comes to Shammai and then to Hillel. He says, "Convert me on the condition that I can be a high priest." Convert can't be a high priest because he's not born into the family of Aaron. But there's a third case. The third case, the proselyte, the potential convert, comes to Shammai and he says, "Convert me on the condition that I don't believe in the oral code. I don't believe in the code that was given at the same time that the Torah was given, the written code." That's what's known as the Mishnah and the Talmud that explains what the meaning of the written code is. Shammai is very insulted. He bounces him out. He comes to Hillel and he says, "Convert me to Judaism on the condition that I don't believe, I don't accept the oral code." Hillel says, "Okay, let's study." They begin to study the first lesson. He teaches them the alphabet. Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. He says, "Go home and study." Comes back the next day. And Hillel says to the proselyte, what did you learn?" And he rattles it off. Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. Hillel says to him, "Oh no, you're mistaken. It's Dalet, Gimel, Bet, Aleph." He says, "Listen, don't make fool of me just because I'm not Jewish. I'm not an idiot. I'm not a moron. I know the alphabet. I could memorize these four letters." Hillel says to him, "How do you know what I taught you yesterday was correct? You don't know anything. And I could be teaching you what's incorrect." In the same manner, what do you know about the written code? What do you know about the oral code? At the end of your studies, you'll have enough information to make an intelligent decision. And if at the end of the studies you come to the conclusion that agrees with what traditional Judaism says, then you'll be converted. Now what's the difference between Shammai and Hillel? When the proselyte said to him, to Shammai, "I don't believe in the oral code," to Shammai, doubt was denial. He denied it. "I can't accept him." To Hillel, doubt was not denial. Doubt left open the possibility that we can study, that we can grow. And that's what Judaism is all about. Judaism says that doubt is good. That doubt leads to questioning. that doubt leads to answering, to asking questions. And you learn more from doubt. That's why we speak about belief in God. Because if I said, for instance, I believe that there's, if I said, I know that there's someone in the next room, there's no doubt about it. I believe there's someone in the next room. I hear the noise, I hear the footsteps, I hear the talking, but I don't know for sure. That's what belief in God is all about. We can narrow the gap. We can narrow the questioning. But there's always going to be that lacuna. There's always going to be that little black spot. And that's what's called the leap of faith. At some point, we're going to have to take a leap of faith. I can't prove it, but it seems to be that way. And that's exactly what we're going to study. Because in Judaism, we say in Yiddish, "Fanakasha shtarpminish." Anybody know Yiddish here? Rabbi Shlush is Sephardic. You don't die from a question. There's nothing lethal about a question. Questioning is healthy. It's good. It's refreshing. It's exciting. That's why the whole Talmud is a book of questions. We ask about the verses in the Bible. We ask about God's behavior. We ask about Moses' behavior. How could God do this? We question God. That's good. Because it leads to growth, which is the most important element and feature of Judaism. Let's take a look at the source sheet that I gave you. It's a very brief source. Now, this source is Exodus 20. It is the first statement of the Ten Commandments. Now, you know that the Ten Commandments is a misnomer. We call the Ten Commandments in Hebrew what? Aseret Hadibrot. If it were the Ten Commandments in Hebrew, it would be Aseret HaMitzvot. It would be a mitzvah. But it's not. It's not a mitzvah. We're not talking about 10 mitzvahs. We're talking about 10 statements. Because not all of the statements involve a mitzvah, which we'll see in just a moment. According to some counts, there are 15 or 20 mitzvot in the 10 commandments. According to Sadia Gaon, there are 613 subsumed in those 10 statements. But we'll refer to it as the 10 commandments. And the 10 commandments appear twice in the Bible. Once in Exodus 20 and one in Deuteronomy 5. Now we're going to see later on that there are differences between the two statements of the Ten Commandments. But right now in this first commandment, there is no difference. And this is what the statement reads. Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hoceiticha Me'aretz Mitzrayim Mibeit Avadim. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. So we see right away, is this a commandment? Is this a commandment? What's the commandment that's brought down in the first statement? Stephen, I'm going to pick on the people I know.
I don't know.
What's this, what does it say? I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. What commandment is here? Yes.
Believe
in God. Where does it say that?
Doesn't say that.
It's implied, okay? In other words, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. Believe in me, then that would be a commandment. But this is not a commandment. It doesn't say that. That's why they say that not all the statements are commanded. And one of the reasons that they say that it's not a commandment is because God can't command you to believe in him. Because then it's not belief. God can't force you to believe in him. In fact, the Talmud says, Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyirat shamayim. Everything is in the hands of God. Except fear of God. Because it has to be volitional. It has to be of your own will. God can't command you. So what does it say here in this statement? I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. It's interesting. It doesn't say I'm the God who created the heavens and earth. It says I'm God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And he was talking, of course, to the people of that generation who went out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. I believe what this first statement is telling us, and it's very interesting that the Torah would start with this, the Ten Commandments would even begin with this. If you want to know God, if you want to know God, study Jewish history. If you want to know God, study the remarkable history of the Jewish people. It is absolutely fascinating. You know, what did Arnold Toynbee, who wasn't a very good friend of the Jews, one of the great historians of the past century, what did he say about the Jews? He says, I don't understand the Jews. They are a fossil in history. They don't fit into the pattern of all nations. Nations rise, decline, cease to exist. What's this about the Jewish people? And the truth of the matter is that the mere existence of the Jewish people is an indication that there's something very, very special or funny going on with them. Why do they seem to exist eternally, while the great empires of ancient times no longer exist? The Egyptians of ancient times are not the Egyptians of today. The Egyptians of the Chinese of today are not the Chinese of ancient times. They're different people. They've assimilated. Different nations have overrun them. They're different. The Romans were the most powerful. The Greeks were the most powerful. They ceased to exist. The Jewish people, for some reason or other, continue to exist. And it seems to be as if there's a finger of God directing their history. It cannot be explained. It's irrational. They weren't the most powerful people on the face of the earth. They weren't the largest number of people on the face of the earth. Why did they seem to exist and other nations falter? So that's one indication. The fact that the Jewish people exist seems to be an indication that they're being directed, perhaps with a divine force. Perhaps. Perhaps. But not only that. If you take a look at closely to Jewish history, you'll see that in every generation, as we say in the Passover Haggadah, Bechol dor vador, in every single generation, Omdim aleinu lechaloteinu, they rise up to destroy us. And somehow, we regenerate. We come alive again. In every single generation, we were at the precipice of being destroyed. And here we are again. We're still here. There were very, very few of us left after each of the destructions. And yet, we're still here. We're still here. And if you take a look at Jewish history, there's a very interesting book by Matthias Cantor. It's called the Jewish Timeline Encyclopedia. And basically, he goes through each age, virtually almost every single year in Jewish life. He tells you what happened, which rabbis, what books were written, what incidents occurred. But he also tells you what the fate of the Jewish people were. And you see that they were almost destroyed in every generation. And for instance, you know, we endured the slavery in Egypt. Achashverosh, even before Achashverosh, 586, the destruction of the temple, the first temple, in 586 by the hand of the Babylonians. Achashverosh, the Purim story, 70 years after the destruction of the temple. Haman wanted to destroy us. The Syrian Greek government, in the time of Hanukkah, outlaws the practice of Judaism in Israel. In the year 70 after the Common Era, the Romans destroyed the second temple under Titus. Muhammad watched 600 Jews decapitated in Medina in a single day in the year 624. In 1096, the First Crusade, thousands of Jews were tortured and massacred. In 1290, the Jews were expelled from England. In 1306, the first expulsion of the Jews from France. In 1492, the Jews were expelled from Spain. 1496, they were expelled from Portugal. In 1648, the Cossacks under Khmelnytsky massacred hundreds of thousands of Jews. 1840, a blood libel in Damascus. In 1862, Ulysses S. Grant expels the Jews from Tennessee. And of course, the Holocaust. So in every generation, they rise up and try to destroy us. And we're here. Now, if I were to take a test tube and put sodium and chlorine in it, and every time it comes out as salt, would you say it's an accident? And nevertheless, every time this happens with the Jewish people survive. You say, oh, it's just an accident of fate. But it's not. In fact, I would argue that it takes more to believe that the existence of the Jewish people points to the existence of a divine director than it does to say it's just an accident, because it didn't happen with any other people. Let's go on. One of the best places to try to find God is by studying the book of God, presumed book of God, that is, and that is the Torah. And I would argue that if you study the weekly portion every single week, you will find the most remarkable insights into life, into psychology, into education, into understanding than any other volume on the face of the earth. Each week there are new revolutionary ideas that are revealed in the weekly portion. In fact, when I was younger, I used to write them down every week as I go through the weekly portion to say, gee, is this remarkable? Gee, I don't understand this. Let me mark it down. Let me try to study this. Well, let's take a look at the verse that we have right in front of us. I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Now, one of the basic principles of Torah study is that there's no redundancies, no extra words in the Bible. And if you take a look at this verse, it seems to go contrary to that statement. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. What's redundant here? What seems to be redundant? What's unnecessary here? What would you say? What could we do with? What could we do without? Okay, out of the house of bondage. Or, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Everybody knows that the land of Egypt is the house of bondage. I am the land of Egypt who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Or, you could just say, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the house of bondage. Okay, everybody knows that the house of bondage was Egypt. Why does it have to say the house of bondage and Egypt? And listen closely. What was Egypt in those years? What was Egypt in those years? Egypt was the cradle of civilization and culture. In Egypt, they first learned how to write cuneiform. They first developed papyri writing. They created those incredible structures, the pyramids. Today, the engineers don't understand how these ancient people built those pyramids. There was art and opera, hieroglyphics, embalming. You know, they knew how to embalm much better than we do. Every undertaker would give their left arm to learn how they did the embalming. When they opened up the sarcophagus of King Tut, they thought he was alive. His skin was so fresh. We haven't mastered that yet. They had incredibly advanced culture. And nevertheless, this cradle of civilization was able to take little Jewish boys and throw them into the river and drown them. According to the Medrash, they would take little Jewish children when the Jews didn't provide enough bricks and plaster them into the walls. And this civilized culture, supposedly civilized culture, was completely indifferent. You know that there were Nazis, stormtroopers, who would cry to the music of Wagner and the poetry of Goethe and Schiller, and were totally indifferent to the cries of the little Jewish children going to the crematorium. Don't ever confuse culture with civilization. That's what this verse is saying. Look at this verse. You don't see it there, but that's what it's saying. Why are those extra words there? One of the most important principles that we can ever learn in our lives. Don't ever confuse culture with civilization. Just because someone has a PhD after their name doesn't mean that he's civilized. Just because someone is the president of a state Or the king of a land. Doesn't mean that he's more civilized than a shoemaker. In fact, it may be just the opposite, because it's harder for them to be civilized. And just because they know culture and poetry and art and architecture, and they walk around like dainty people, doesn't mean that they are moral people. Don't ever confuse culture with civilization. One of the most important principles that we could ever master. Now, one of the most important principles that you could ever master in this class tonight is to learn that I was born in the Bronx. Very important, because I keep repeating that all the time. I was born in the Bronx. I'm just a plebe from the Bronx. I'm not even a real rabbi. I'm a beginner's rabbi. For 32 years, I've been conducting this beginner service. I'm trying to become a real rabbi. Maybe Rabbi Schlish will ordain me and become a real rabbi. And one of the interesting things for a guy from the Bronx was that I used to love to go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art certain parts of the year. There were times when I was in high school where we used to go Thursday night ice skating at the old Madison Square Garden. Friday, when the spring season came, we used to play baseball in Prospect Park in Brooklyn. But there was a couple of weeks, a couple of months in between where we didn't have anything to do. And this kid from the Bronx wound up in the Metropolitan Museum of Art on Fifth Avenue. And I used to go into the Greek sculpture room. I was obsessed with Greek sculpture. And if you've ever been there, it's really something to remember. Because if you look at these sculptures, they're absolutely amazing. They're marble. They're etched in such an incredible manner that sometimes if you look carefully, you could think that those marble sculptures are alive and breathing. You see the sinews on their arms, the veins. You could see the expressions on their faces, even though they may be broken. But they are so alive. They're much better than the wax museum. And I would just sit there and admire them, sometimes for hours. And then I learned a little bit about Greco-Roman history. One of the things that I learned was that there were no challenged people in Greece or Rome. No one was disabled. There was no one who was blind or deaf or crippled. Because anyone who was born with a disability was not allowed to live. They didn't believe in direct murder, but they used to leave them out at night to die of the cold if they were infants. Die of exposure or starvation. And looking at those sculptures, I saw perfect, beautiful people. And I said to myself, admiring those sculptures is, in an indirect, maybe even direct way, admiring that culture. And I have to be aware of what went in to the manufacturing of those sculptures. Never confuse culture with civilization. Just because they were gifted artists doesn't mean that they were moral. I remember taking a tour on a boat in the San Francisco Bay. And they take you on this boat, the cruise boat. The announcer is announcing. On your right is Alcatraz, where the Birdman of Alcatraz was filmed. And here's the Golden Gate Bridge. Went into a lengthy discussion about the incredible structure of the Golden Gate Bridge. They told you how long it was, how many miles. They told you how many tons of steel went into its manufacture. How many cables, miles of cables were involved? How much asphalt was laid on it each season? How many tolls they collected? How many people died in its building? How many gallons of orange paint it takes to paint the bridge, and how long it takes for the painters to paint the entire bridge? Very, very specific details. And he mentioned the number of people who died in the building of the Golden Gate Bridge in the same tone and the same voice that he mentioned the gallons of paint or the miles of cable. It was as if the human beings were no more valuable than the tolls that were collected. Don't ever confuse culture with civilization. We have to be aware of that.
I remember I was alive in 1975, in June of 1975, when an Eastern Boeing 727 crashed at JFK Airport. It was then the worst crash, the most lethal crash in the history of the airport. 123 of 174 passengers died. Among them were some very notable people. A few days later, a famous racehorse died. Name was Ruffian. Ruffian had won the Kentucky Derby. And they said he was the greatest racehorse of all times. And of course, they didn't say that Ruffian died. They said Ruffian was laid to rest. Ruffian was put to sleep. Ruffian this and Ruffian. No human being of the people that died on the plane, of the notable human being, got any sort of coverage, any eulogies, any obituaries, the way Ruffian, the racehorse, did. And of course, he was buried in great majesty at Belmont Racetrack. And you can still go and see the tombstone of Ruffian.
It just happened recently. Remember that in January of 2007, after 8 months of the most extensive and extraordinary efforts ever to save a racehorse's life, Barbaro, who won the Kentucky Derby and was injured in the Preakness, was euthanized. You remember what a great day of mourning that was, the efforts to save that racehorse.
I have nothing against racehorses, but I do have something against people who don't make the distinction between what is moral and what is culture. It's very, very important, because we often don't make that distinction.
Now, why do I bring this up? Why am I spending so much time on this? Because this is just one of many hundreds of revolutionary principles that are found in the Torah that we don't see in other parts of our lives, that we're not told about. The Torah was the first to introduce the idea of charity. The idea that you have to help the poor, the downtrodden. We introduced it into the world. That the orphan has to be taken care of. The widow has to be taken care of. It was a revolutionary idea. How come Confucius didn't come up with it? How come other civilizations didn't come up with it? And you know that there are other belief systems that don't believe in it. So, for instance, you know, the Japanese don't believe in outside charity. Until recently. I remember when they gave a grant of $1 million to establish a Japanese institute in Harvard. The country was up in arms. What do you mean giving money? That was way back then. Japanese money away. That was not part of their culture. Today it is. In Calvinism, basically, Orthodox Calvinism says, you're not supposed to help these people who are downtrodden. Because if you do, you're preventing them from being healed. It's God's wish that they suffer. And you're preventing them from suffering so they can be healed. You're intervening with God's command. And Judaism says, I don't know what God's wishes are. That's not for me to determine. If I see a person suffering, a person extends his hand, I don't care what your feelings are. You have to respond. That was uniquely Jewish. Thou shalt not murder. Uniquely Jewish. Hey, wait a second, Buchwald. What are you talking about? Hammurabi had in his code 300 years before Judaism. But in Hammurabi's code, it meant something entirely different. Even though it said the exact same words. Thou shalt not murder. But in Hammurabi's code, it was lex talionis. It was an eye for an eye. And what did it mean? It meant that if I killed my neighbor's son, my neighbor could come and kill my son. If I raped my neighbor's daughter, my neighbor could come and rape my daughter or take my daughter as a concubine. If I killed my neighbor's slave,
I can give him 18 camels and we'd be even. In other words, what I was basically doing is compensating my neighbor for the loss of his property, of his chattel. Judaism said no. Every person is responsible for his own actions. You don't punish a third innocent party for something that he had nothing to do with. Every person is responsible for his own actions. When you take another person's life, you have not committed a crime against their owner, their father, their possessor. You've committed a crime against what we call God. What we in America call society. We've secularized God and we say society. That's why it doesn't say the family of the deceased, versus John Doe, the murderer. We don't say that. The charge is the family of the deceased or the deceased versus the state of New York versus the perpetrator. The Queen of England versus the perpetrator. It's a crime against society. It's a crime against the state. They just secularized it. That was uniquely and revolutionary Jewish. Why didn't other nations come up with it? Why didn't other people come up with it? How come it's always Judaism that comes up with it? We were the first environmentalists. It's our Torah that says, the first chapters of Genesis. It says that we're put on the earth to work the land and to guard the land. We were the first members of the Sierra Club. We were the first members of the Save the Darter Snail movement. It's our Torah that says that you can't chop down a fruit-bearing tree, even in times of war. It's our Torah that says that you can't divert the waterworks, even in time of war. It's our Torah that said this 3,300 years ago. It's our Torah that says you have to get rid of your waste properly. It says so, that every soldier, in addition to carrying his weapons, has to carry a spade with him. So that your camp will be holy, sanctified. The whole idea of sanctity is Jewish. Sanctified. The day of the Shabbat. Revolutionarily Jewish. Other civilizations had dangerous days, black days. But no one had a day of rest. Everyone, many civilizations had phases of the moon. When it was dangerous to go out. But they didn't have a Shabbat, a day of rest, of restoration, and we'll talk about that. It's the most revolutionary idea. How do I know that it's revolutionary? It was just recently confirmed by an article in the New York Times, in the Holy New York Times. There was a recent article there by a writer who says he turns off one day a week. No cell phone, no internet, no Blackberries. Nothing. And he just reads or he talks to one another, to other people. He has to get away from the world that's too much with us. And that's the most amazing thing. You can't have quality time unless you have quantity time. And we'll talk about when we get to Shabbat.
Judaism has proven to be the most effective method, educational method, of educating large numbers of people over long periods of time. Yeah, there may be some guru up in the Himalayas who's talking, you know, to 10 people and living a very moral and righteous life, but no one has ever been able to do it with large numbers of people over long periods of time. That doesn't mean that everybody in Judaism, every Jew is moral. We know that, unfortunately, there are many Jews who are not moral. But the record of the Jewish people is unparalleled. Really unparalleled. And whenever anyone was wicked, they were put down. They weren't elevated into sainthood. Take a look at the many of the saints in the Christian church. They were vicious murderers. That's what's so amazing. It's our Torah that says that you're not allowed to eat until you feed your goldfish. In fact, we say that twice a day in the Shema. Livemtecha v'yachalta v'savata. You have to feed your animals before you can eat. On Shabbat, you want to make a Shabbat meal. You have to make sure that your little hamster is fed.
before you eat. It's our Torah that says that you're not allowed to muzzle an animal while it's working in the field. You're not allowed to attach a donkey and an ox together because the ox is so much stronger you can't hurt them. It's our Torah that says you're not allowed to look the other way when an animal is falling under its load. Can you imagine this? When people were eating animals alive. This is the Torah. Judaism has proven to be the most effective method of educating large numbers of people over long periods of time to ethical and moral living.
Is it a proof of God's existence? No. But the more evidences you bring, the more compelling the case is. Why is it Judaism that has it? Why is it the Torah that has it? Doesn't it take more faith to believe the other way, that it was just an accident, it just happened, that all these revolutionary ideas were found in this book? Why weren't these found in Confucius? Why weren't there 300 brilliant men in another civilization that came up with this? And that's very, very compelling. There are other indications. For instance, let's say you might have heard about the discovery codes, where you study the Bible and they seem to be little signatures within the Bible about the portions that you're reading, or the orderliness of the world, the theory of chaos. Why does everything happen to have so much order? Why is there the quantum theory? Why does gravity work? Everything seems to be so orderly. If it was so orderly, did it happen by chance? Or was there an architect?
But I think there's another compelling reason, which I personally find the most compelling reason. And that is what we say every single day. The Shema Yisrael, the seminal prayer of the Jewish people, the acceptance of the dominion of God upon us. We say it, Shema Yisrael, hear O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And the first paragraph begins, V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavecha u'v'chol nafshecha u'v'chol me'odecha.
You should love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might.
Now, if this is supposed to be the acceptance of the dominion of God upon us, why is this verse in the Bible speaking about love of God? It shouldn't say you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. It should say what? What should it say? What should it say? You should believe. You should believe in the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Why does it say love?
Because love has the capacity to open up the heart so that your mind can be open, so that you can believe. Love is very, very important. Now, in case you didn't master one of the most important principles that I taught tonight, I'm going to repeat it for you. And that is that I'm from the Bronx.
Finally got a laugh from you. God almighty. Tough crowd. So in the Bronx, we used to play different games. Scully, stickball, two sewer man, etc. But the girls used to play jump rope. And the girls used to sing a song when they played jump rope. I understand that some places they still sing the song. It went like this. I am a pretty little Dutch girl, as pretty can be. And all the boys around my block are crazy over me. My boyfriend's name is Jello. He comes from Monticello, with a pimple on his nose and five black toes, and that's the way my story goes. None of you ever heard that? A couple of you, okay. You know, they used to jump also. And a J space, and a J space. Remember that? You know, there's a kosher milk called J&J. In Borough Park, they jump rope to J&J milk, J&J. You know. In any case, let's just analyze this very, very important song that these girls used to sing. All right? I'm pretty little Dutch girl. Pretty little boys around the block, crazy over me. My boyfriend's name is Jello. Can you imagine a person having a name Jello? And the girl is raving about it. I have a boyfriend by the name of Jello. I mean, that sounds like a wimp to me. God, I would publicize that. He comes from Monticello. I don't think he's coming from Monticello, you know, where, you know, the sophisticated Monticello. He's talking about the broken down Monticello upstate New York, okay? Don't hope I'm not insulting anybody. Bronx wasn't that beautiful either. and he has a pimple on his nose and five black toes. And that's what she's raving about, okay? She's raving about the pimple on his nose and five black toes. Well, you know, if you're in love, pimple on your nose can be very beautiful, okay? Think of Barbara Streisand's nose. Think about it, okay? People go crazy over her. They think she's the most beautiful creature on the face of the earth. And Lauren Hutton's space between her teeth. Ooh, it's gorgeous. It's unbelievable. And five black toes. My boyfriend has five black toes. Nobody else in the neighborhood has five black toes. We're proud of her. Proud of him. Because I love him. Because love opens up vistas that other people cannot see. Okay? You go to the opera, and this big baritone gets up there, big, you know, Pavarotti type, and he's booming away. Okay? To someone who's uninitiated in opera, that guy is making a lot of noise, just a lot of noise. To someone who loves opera, every little trill note. Oh, I remember Pavarotti in Milan. I remember the Paris opera. I remember at the Metropolitan. I remember how he sang it. I remember that high C. And you go crazy. If you love, it opens up vistas that no one else could see. That's why the Shema begins, V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha. Open up your heart. That's what the Shema is saying. Open up your heart. Start loving God. The Kutzker Rebbe was asked, where do you find God? And he said, where you let him in. One of the most religious poems I've ever encountered in my life is a poem called Renaissance or Renaissance by a poet by the name of Edna St. Vincent Millay. I think it was composed in the year 1912 when she was 20 years old. And Edna St. Vincent Millay, who wasn't Jewish, she wrote as follows. I don't know it all by heart. It's a very long poem. It's worth getting a hold of. She wrote, all I could see from where I stood was three long mountains and a wood. In other words, when she looked out into the world, all she saw in her world was three long mountains and a wood. And she turned the other way and that's all she saw again. She looked at the heavens and she said, heavens are not so tall. The sea is not so deep. And the world is not so special. You know why? Because wherever she looked, she saw pain and suffering. She said, this world is filled with a lot of angst. This world is filled with a lot of pain. And you know, it's ripping my heart out. The sky is not tall. The sea is not deep. I looked into the ocean and I saw two great ships crash in the ocean. And the people were screaming as they were drowning. And I felt each scream tear into my throat. I saw a man in Capri. He turned his eyes. He looked at me. I knew his hunger as my own. All I could see in this world was travail and pain and sorrow. The Jewish word. Tzaris. Pain. And after a while, the poet says, I couldn't take it anymore. All this misery. And I cried out to heaven and I said, God, give me relief. Remove this mass from off my chest. Give me a break. Set me free from the pain and the travail of all the other people. And she says, I know not how such things could be, but all of a sudden a great wind came and took my body and placed it on a very soft cushion. And I realized that I was 6 feet underground and I was lying on fresh dug earth and there was a little pillow under my head. And I said, gee, how great. No troubles. No tzaris, no pain, no travail can follow me here. Finally, I'm free, I'm relieved. Thank you, God, for relieving me of the pain. She prayed for death, and she died. And now she's free. And she says, I was lying in my grave and I said, oh, it's such a beautiful place. And all of a sudden, the patter of rain was heard on my thatched roof, on the grass above her. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I'm never ever going to see the rain fall again. I'm never going to see a bead of water of rain roll down on a blade of grass. And after the rainstorm, the sky will clear and grow clear again and blue again. And there'll be a scent from the apple orchard that is so incredible, and I'll never ever be able to experience that again. And suddenly she missed the things that she had never ever appreciated before in life. And she said, oh God, give me another chance. Sweep me from my death. Sweep me from my grave. Give me another chance. She says, I know not how such things could be. But all of a sudden, this great whirlwind came and swept her from the grave. And she fell on the grass. And she kissed the earth. And like a wild man, she ran to the first tree and she hugged the tree around and round. And she says, God, nothing will ever be able to hide from me your incredible infinity. Never. And she says, only a person who's dead and comes alive again can appreciate the gifts that you've given us. Only a person who dies and is bereft of those gifts can really appreciate what you've given us. You can walk however silently, but my ears will hear you. You can try to sneak by me, but my eyes will behold you. You'll never, never disappear from me again. And she said, the sky is only as high as the heart is wide, and the earth is only as wide as the soul is wide, and he whose heart is flat, the earth will cave in on him by and by. That's what Yom Kippur is, by the way. Yom Kippur is our annual experience of dying. We don't eat, we don't drink, we don't wear leather shoes, we don't engage in sex, we don't bathe. We have to die in order to appreciate life. And the truth of the matter is that all you have to do is look around to this wonderful mixed up world that we have and pick out the most magnificent and significant gifts that God has given us. Doesn't mean that you have to avoid looking at the bad things, but it's the good things that we have, the gifts that we've been given, the medical miracles that we experience every single day, the advancement of humankind. That's what's so great. And so I think I'm going to end here, because we can't prove God's existence. But I think that by opening up our heart, by hugging a tree, by kissing the ground, by looking at God's works, by studying Jewish history, by studying the Torah and seeing the incredible revolutionary, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of revolutionary ideas that were introduced to this world, not by accident, I believe, we can make a compelling case that there is a God, and that there was a Creator, and that all of religion and theology is much more than loving your neighbor than yourself, as revolutionary as that idea is. The answer is Zil Gemor. What Hillel told the proselyte is go out and study. We have the most wonderful endowments, the most wonderful gifts to study. But we have to make it available to ourselves. The greatest tragedy of contemporary times is that we're living in the era of the most highly educated Jews in all of Jewish history, and the most ignorant Jews, Jewishly, in all of Jewish history. What we have to do is, as the Kutzker Rebbe said, "Wie gefindt man him? Where do we find him? B'malastam arayin, where we let God in." We have to open up the door. We have to open up our hearts. We have to open up the books. We have to badger the rabbis, gang up on the rabbis, and say, "I need to know more. Let me study." Don't give away this treasured tradition for less than a pot of lentils. It's just too valuable. We have so much to teach the world, and we need to be those ambassadors. Thank you.